Welcome to the New In Chess podcast. You're listening to a story from The Essential Sisunko, Collected Portraits and Tales of a Bygone Chess Era by Grandmaster Genna Sisunko. Since the 1980s, he has written extensively for New In Chess magazine. Sisunko's chess writings, rather than being technical, chronicle the lives of the former and current top players with whom he has crossed paths. Today's episode continues the two-part story about Mikhail Botvinnik. As the founder of the Soviet chess school, Botvinnik was instrumental in the Soviet Union's dominating the world of chess for decades to come. His single-mindedness, strong convictions, and unwavering belief in himself made him an example for the many that followed in his footsteps. Enjoy the stories in today's reading, narrated by professional voice actor Nick Murphy, from The Essential Sisunko, Chapter 4, Mikhail Botvinnik, continued.
With Karpov, I got on well, but we fell out when he started asserting that there was no such thing as the Soviet school of chess, and later when he began oppressing Kasparov. I took Kasparov's side, since I considered that they should be in equal conditions, and this terrible episode, when their match was terminated, here everyone took part, the Central Committee, the Sports Committee, the Federation, and Campo. From 1973 to 1978, Gary attended my school. When it was closed, the two of us simply kept meeting. I did everything I could to support him. I arranged his participation in the Sokolsky Memorial, where he won easily and became a master. I did the same for the tournament in Banja Luka, where he became a grandmaster. Gary now plays worse than he did 10 years ago, and his style has changed. He used to play like Capablanca, as I taught him, by position. But a few years ago I noticed that, in the interest of safety, he was going in for simplifications. And after the position had been simplified, he would employ his tactical talent. No, I don't think that it is a matter of age. He has simply realized that his first aim should be not to lose. You know that every tenor can hit a certain number of high C's in his career, perhaps also in chess. A player can play only a certain number of good games, and for the rest of the time he simply moves the pieces. I think the only thing that can save him as a chess player is to give up all this rubbish that he is now occupied with, but I'm used to people turning their backs on me. In the end, I helped Kasparov, not because of his personal qualities, but because he is such a wonderful player. Who do I rate more highly, Kasparov or Karpov? Well, of course they are both outstanding talents, but the one with the more versatile talent is Karpov. Have you seen my book, Anatoly Karpov, His Road to the World Championship? He played fantastically in these matches. How he won against Spassky! Spassky was still very strong. A few months before their match, he had won the 1973 USSR Championship. And what a championship! Nevertheless, in their match, Karpov simply crushed him. But then Karpov stopped playing at full strength. Why? I don't know. Perhaps in the money-chess combination, money became more important. But what he showed recently at the tournament in Linares indicates that he has retained his talent. With whom would I like to remain on a desert island, Karpov or Kasparov? I would say this. I now have quite good relations with Karpov. But if I had to choose between Karpov the champion and Kasparov the champion, I would prefer to remain alone on this desert island. What about the young? I remember when Kramnik was 12. He played very cautiously, very correctly. He very quickly grew stronger, and he now plays more boldly. But he simply shows a lack of respect for himself. He is fat, he drinks, and he smokes. He lost shamefully to Kamsky and also to Gelfand, now he avoids me, goes the other way. Shirov is an original talent. In some ways he reminds me of Korshnoi, but I think his nervous system is not in order. With him things are first good, and then bad. He is sharp and impulsive, and he is capable of criticizing anyone. No, I don't see him as a world champion. Before we talk about a future champion, order has to be restored in the chess world. All these rapid play tournaments, everything is bash, bash. It's a mockery of chess. Did you see how Kasparov lost to a computer? Oh, an insipid game. The computer played insipidly, but Kasparov was simply dreadful. But I understood this even before the match in London. When I was speaking to his mother, I realized that for them, money was everything. No, chess has not changed. It has not become different. This is all fairy tales for young children. It is only that the initial information is now easier to obtain, but the process of analysis has remained the same. A chess player should himself analyze, and a lot, and nothing can replace analysis. The best of my analytical works, I think that I wrote it during the war, when I annotated all the games from the tournament for the title of absolute USSR champion. In 1943, I wrote to Molotov that I was losing my chess strength, and so he drew up a resolution. Comrade Botvinnik must without fail retain his chess capabilities and must be given the time necessary for further improvement. That was how I was given 2 free days a week, which was when I wrote the book. I remember Bukowski bringing Belyavsky to me when he was 17 to ask my opinion on his play. It was evident that he was talented, but he knew nothing and he simply played slapdash. Therefore, I gave him this book so that he could learn to analyze. A few months later, he returned it and said that he had looked for at least one mistake in the analyses, but had failed to find one. When was my play at its strongest? Well, of course, in 1948, I played well. I prepared with all my heart, and I showed what I was capable of. And in the USSR Championship of 1945, I played well, when I scored 16 out of 18. Yes, and in the return match with Tal, although by then I was already 50. I prepared very well and surprised everyone, including Tal. You wrote a nice article about Tal, but you defined his style incorrectly. In our second match, I showed how to play against him. When his pieces were leaping about the board, he had no equals, but when there was a solid pawn structure in the centre, then positionally he was weak. He had to be restricted. Restricted. Yes, Tal, I remember that in Munich in 1958, there was a tram stop, Talstrasse. We all joked that it had been named in Misha's honour. He was ill, you say, but he was ill all his life. And what in fact happened? Romanov called me, footnote, N. Romanov, chairman of the sports committee of the Soviet Union at the time, end footnote, to say that the match was to be postponed. Tal was ill. Is there an official doctor's statement? What doctor's statement? He says he is ill. But there is a rule, I said. There must be a certificate. We began shouting at each other. In the evening, Romanov phoned me to say that the match was on. He had called Tal in Riga to say that he should be officially examined, and Tal had refused. In general, after their matches with me, Bronstein, Smyslov and Tal no longer showed their former strength. I am to blame for this, since it was I who unclosed them, and then everyone understood how to play against them. No, I have never smoked, with the exception of 2 months in my youth, and I have not taken alcohol. I used to eat 1.5 hours before a game. Then I would lie down, but not sleep, simply lie down, because when you are lying down, no one bothers you with idle conversation. At first, I used to take black currant juice with lemon with me to a game. My wife herself used to squeeze it. Then I took to drinking coffee. At one time, I used to eat chocolate during play. Not a bad idea, I think. For myself, I noticed the following. If I put on weight during a tournament, it meant that I had played badly. And if I came back after a game not feeling tired, that was also bad. But if I was exhausted, then everything was in order. After my game with Capablanca in Amsterdam, 1938, I couldn't get up from my chair. Sleep, of course, is important. What did Spassky say to you regarding sleep? Rubbish, most probably. But he was a great player. Great! He was a continuation of Lasker's line. It was of little interest to him what others were doing. He had his own opinion. In his first match with Petrosian, he played very well. But I think that Bondarevsky misled him. In the second match with Petrosian, he was simply splendid. I think that he lost to Fischer through stupidity. He overrated himself. And what happened to him afterwards? You know that creativity and money accompany each other? The question is, which is more important? Either money in order to play chess, or chess in order to earn money? Well, he switched to the second system and lost interest in chess. And it was lucky for him that he played that idiotic second match with Fischer in Yugoslavia and secured himself financially. So, about sleep. I always used to sleep very well up to the time of the third Moscow tournament of 1936. It was terribly hot. There was a constant noise on the street, and I was unable to sleep. But I was young, and despite my insomnia, I played well. I forced myself to play. Then my sleep was somehow restored, but not completely. Without any doubt, one day a machine will play stronger than any human. And there is nothing here to fear. Chess will become more popular. After all, people run in stadia, although the bicycle and especially the car are much quicker. No, here there is no need to fear. But writing such a program is not a simple matter. Do you know what I realized yesterday at the lecture? That to write a program for managing the economy is easier than for chess. Because chess is a two-sided game, antagonistic. The players hinder each other. And the devil knows what that means. Whereas in economics, this is not the case and everything is simpler.
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way, on-the-spot reports of the biggest events, top-notch instruction, independent journalism, chess history that comes to life, and great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition, or the digital edition for phone, tablet, or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
No, I never saw Stalin. I talked on the telephone with Proskorobyshev, his assistant, but I never saw Stalin. But I have a telegram. I received it in January 1939, after I had sent Molotov a letter regarding my match with Alyakin. The telegram read, "If you decide to challenge Alyakin, the chess player, to a match, we wish you complete success. The rest is not difficult to ensure. Molotov." I always thought that Molotov had written it, but once I read it with a Caucasian accent, and I realised that it was Stalin's style. Especially, the rest is not difficult to ensure. Then I have hanging on the wall in the chess centre a 1950 decree with Stalin's signature. Stalin, after all, was not only a negative figure, he played a dual role. He strengthened the state. And although people lived in poverty, the majority supported him. Tens of millions of lives, do you say? You know, I do not really believe this. There were camps, of course, but many returned from the camps, very many, including some of my friends. I do not really believe these figures. Although Stalin very skillfully camouflaged his evil deeds, the first time I sensed that he was a liar was in 1952, when the trial of the Doctor murderers was announced. I also remember a reception at Vyshinsky's. Footnote: A. Vyshinsky, 1883 to 1954, Soviet general prosecutor at that time. Even before the war, I had championed the idea that chess tournaments should be conducted like musical competitions, that chess was not inferior to the violin. Vyshinsky said that there was no money, so I asked him if there was money for music competitions. He made no reply. Vyshinsky adapted himself to circumstances, but he was a capable person. In what sense? He was a good lawyer, talented, but unprincipled. With Krylenko, it was a different matter. He was kind, just principled, and he loved chess madly. But, of course, party discipline and directions of the Central Committee were the law for him. I saw Khrushchev once at an exhibition. He had an enormous stomach, and the photographers were shouting to him, "A photograph, Nikita Sergeyevich?" And he says, "Whereabouts?" Here Brezhnev, who was with him, got down on the ground, offered his knee, and Khrushchev sat down on it. And there they were on the photograph together. In 1961, Brezhnev presented me with a decoration after the return match with Tal. He spoke very warmly, and in general I must say that I liked him. It was only later, when he became ill, that things went wrong with him. Do I have regrets about anything that I did not do right in my life? I made some mistakes, but did not repeat them. Which? Well, it's difficult to say. Sometimes in small matters I made stupid decisions, but this taught me, and so, in general, no. I have no regrets.
He fell silent. The room was filled with the setting sun of a September day in 1994, and at the nearby church it was already striking six. It was evident that he was tired. "Can you see me, Mikhail Moiseevich?" I asked.
"Only your outline."
"Haven't you been to see Fyodorov? Smyslov, for instance, said..."
"Come on, Vasily Vasilyevich's sight is three times better than mine."
On his previous visit, he had nevertheless mentioned that he might see the famous ophthalmologist, but had kept on waiting, thinking that the professor should first read an article he wrote back in 1954, which had just appeared in a historical journal, an article from which it was clear that already then he was in favour of democracy.
"I've been to see Fyodorov. He told me directly that my cells are ageing."
"Does that mean that medicine can't do anything?"
"That's right. True, he offered to do an operation, but I declined."
I looked again at him. His senile hands, the astigmatic look from behind the thick glass of his spectacles, the white, neatly combed hair. He spoke about people, the majority of whom were dead, as if he, in his ninth decade, was not concerned by the concepts of time and age. His lecture to the economics faculty in Tilburg and a press conference devoted to chess showed essentially one and the same fervent, passionate attempt to assert his correctness, often sharp and impatient, disregarding the opinion of his companion or opponent. Very often, he would take as the basis a fact that was by no means evident, and sometimes even highly dubious, and from this fact, he would draw conclusions with iron consistency and merciless logic. At the lecture, the faces of the students dropped when he said, "As you yourselves know, the entire economy of Holland is determined by the three firms, Philips, Hergovens, and Unilever." Having gained, as a result of his enormous talent and iron will, the highest success in one field, he assumed that he could also feel at home in others, where he was considerably less competent. These judgments often looked naive and banal, and sometimes even absurd. However, I have no doubt about his sincerity and his absolute belief in what he said. It is evident that part of the explanation was the country in which he spent his entire conscientious life. A country which held only one idea to be correct, and the rest to be reactionary or erroneous. His evaluations of people and events often combined into a deep penetration into the character of a person and a dogmatic obstinacy in explaining his motives and intentions. One has to give him his due. He developed his theories and hypotheses based on these premises with exceptional clarity and purposefulness. Mikhail Moiseevich's thinking, Smyslov once said to me, is strictly materialistic. I would even say machine-like. However, all is vanity, vanity of vanities, vanity and vexation of spirit. And Mikhail Moiseevich does not even have vexation of spirit. For this reason, the following sentence, virtually unique among all that was written by Botvinnik, sounds unexpectedly moving. In recent years, I have understood what old age is. It is when your friends depart. New ones do not appear, and all that remains is to remember those who have departed. Having once taken a decision, he would follow it firmly without diverging. I think that this quality, this belief in yourself and in the correctness of the chosen plan, of your own idea, is extremely important for a top-class chess player. In some way, this confidence is transferred to the chess pieces. All the world champions who I have seen at close quarters have possessed this quality to some degree. After working out the variations and playing g2 to g4, you have to believe only in the direct attack, and not in the fact that the f4 square is conceded forever. And what will happen if a black knight reaches there? Doubts, which accumulate, alas, with experience, generate a lack of confidence and cause only harm. Once, in a conversation, in order to see his reaction, I recalled what Napoleon had said. "You must always leave yourself the right to laugh tomorrow at that of which you approve today." He replied, "Napoleon could also have told you something different. When did he say this? Was it after 1812, perhaps?" Those who had hurt his feelings, both in life and at the chessboard, he remembered firmly. Once in Brussels, in the press centre at one of the GMA tournaments, discussing some opening position, I said to him that I thought this was an idea of Djindjishashvili. "Djindjishashvili, you say? Well now, I remember, a man to disturb your dreams." At the Spartakiad, names the year and the month, I had a completely won position. Then I relaxed, allowed a tactical stroke, and did not even manage to draw. I can picture him well in the tournament press centre. He always analysed blind, in the last years almost literally, his grey head bending low, sometimes rocking from side to side, as he asked, "Where did you say the pawn was? At d5. The words of the Greek poet Archilochus, "The fox knows many things, the hedgehog one big thing," apply directly to him. In chess there were many splendid foxes in the 30s, 40s and 50s, but he, of course, belonged to the hedgehogs. About chess, he knew something that others did not know. In his final tournament at Leiden in 1970, he was close to a win in many games, but after sharing last place for the first time in his life, he realised that it was not just a matter of chess. He understood perfectly well that in chess there applies that same cruel custom that existed for the inhabitants of Tierra del Fuego. As the young grow up, they kill and eat the old. Remembering that in his time he had written both about Einstein and about Spinoza, I asked,
Mikhail Moiseevich, you know, once Einstein received a telegram from a Brooklyn rabbi asking if it was true that he was atheist. The same day, Einstein, also by telegraph, replied, I believe in the God of Spinoza, which manifests itself in the harmony of everything real, but not in a God that concerns itself with the fates and actions of people. He was silent for a while, and began saying something about brute force, with which one cannot make progress in chess programs. He did not believe, either in the God of Spinoza, and even less so in the God of the Brooklyn rabbi. Although without himself suspecting it, he lived by the wisdom of the Talmud. Life is not suffering and not pleasure, but a matter which must be carried through. His religion became the philosophy of the young new state, together with which he had grown up. His creed became the slogans and ideals of this state. To these ideals, so beautiful on paper and unrealizable in practice, which have now been rejected together with the state itself, he has remained true, with some self-evident corrections, to the end. Rejecting them would have meant deleting his entire life. It was the same in chess. After developing his methods of preparation and his playing principles when he was still young, he remained true to them to the end of his career. His great love during the last period of his life was his computer program. He devoted to it all his time and energy and upheld it passionately. Once, in a conversation, he let slip, I have only one desire, to complete the work on my program. But death, I am not afraid of death. He knew, of course, that most mathematicians were sceptical about his ideas of creating a program that would think like a human, but he firmly believed in his correctness.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
He was a living relic, part of an epoch. And it is impossible to separate or examine him outside of this epoch or outside of its context. Just as it is impossible to understand certain actions of Shostakovich or Pasternak, for example, outside of those times in which they lived, and outside of that amazing, cruel country, so different from any other, but there was also a difference. From the age of 20, when he first became USSR champion, his name became not simply popular, it became a symbol of chess in the country of the Soviets. Just like the name of Mayakovsky in poetry, Ulanova in ballet, or Sholokhov in literature, photographs and articles in newspapers, autographs, and the admiring looks of fans, his direct links to the powers that be, all this, together with his innate qualities, character and talent, made up the phenomenon of Mikhail Botvinnik. I should like to recount two instances which I consider very typical of him. Like the majority of world chess champions, Botvinnik grew up without a father. From childhood, he was trained to a formula, which became for him a formula for life, which can be gleaned from the following. Botvinnik celebrated his 80th birthday, which coincided with the end of the 1991 candidates match in Brussels. There was a big banquet, and he himself made a speech. I translated it as best I could, and when, to the applause of those present, he began descending the staircase, even though he could see virtually nothing, I took him by the arm. No, he said firmly, I myself. This was an unwillingness to submit, to be dependent on someone else, to stop the clocks, to resign. All that he did in chess and in life, all the decisions that he took himself, and having taken them once, he followed them
unbendingly. The other instance was in Tilburg, where he decided to buy several pens for his staff and asked me to help him. Only I definitely want them with black ink, Gennady Borisovich, definitely with black. In the shop, when I said this to the assistant, she asked me to repeat it. Mikhail Moseyevich listened to our conversation, which of course was conducted in Dutch, and then suddenly pushing me aside, in order to clarify things once and for all, he determinedly said, "Schwarz, understand?" The last time I saw him was in December 1994 in Moscow, in the Central Chess Club on Gogolevsky Boulevard, where he still worked every day. It was a typical snowy Moscow day. It was the birthday of one of his staff. There were tea and cakes, and it all seemed that it would be like that forever, that nothing could happen to him, that he would outlive us all. He, with his constant temperature of 35.7, as though conserved. It appeared that he was eternal, and indeed he was strong physically. After receiving Müller's book as a present in childhood, he, all his life, followed his system of gymnastics. I remember how in Brussels in 1988, on our very first acquaintance in the hotel lift, he asked, "Can you do this?" And supporting his hands on metal protuberances, he lifted his feet off the ground and made a right angle with his legs. But then, one day, he fell ill and was taken to hospital, which he positively disliked. The last time had been exactly 50 years earlier, on account of appendicitis. Pleurisy was diagnosed, but his organism would not accept the gamma globulin, and he got worse. But even in this condition, he remained Botvinnik. He told the doctors which preparations were needed to neutralize the reaction. All the conditions in his organism began to develop, and the ultimate cause of his death was cancer of the pancreas. He died bravely, realizing perfectly well that he was dying, with a clear mind and a firm memory, his Botvinnik mind and his Botvinnik memory. Vasily Smyslov remembered, "I was with him at the Novodevichy Cemetery when he said calmly, 'I will be here alongside Ganuchka. There already is a place.' And he rubbed the place where the urn with his ashes now stands. He was calm to the very end, deliberately accepting the formula of the ancients. It is easier for us to be patient there where it is not in our power to change anything. Few can say when they are dying, 'I lived in the way that I considered right.' I think he could have said this. He was at home, surrounded by his loved ones, and with undiminished clarity of mind, he gave the final directions about the morgue, the cremation, and stressed the pointlessness of splendid funerals. In recent years, Kasparov had quarrelled with his former teacher. They had different views on the future of chess and on life in general, but how different they were also similar in their implacability, in their belief that only they were right. A few days after Botvinnik's death, Kasparov was playing in a tournament in Amsterdam. I ran into him an hour after the opening ceremony as he walked out of the hotel, animatedly discussing something with his second. "Do you know, we have just now checked that it takes 20 minutes to get to the tournament hall." "But if you go this way, I think it will be shorter," I remarked. "No, that street is very noisy." Mikhail Botvinnik, with his ideas of more than half a century's antiquity, through disagreements and arguments, years and death, looked approvingly at his pupil. His life contained the most important events of the 20th century, both world wars, the ascent of man into space, and finally, the collapse of one of the most amazing states, of which he was the chess symbol. "What are you intending, Genna, to talk with me about?" he asked, when I switched on the tape recorder. "What do you mean? About life? About life? But what is this for?" Knowing that he did not like such definitions, I nevertheless replied, "For immortality, Mikhail Moseyevich."
"Ah, if you are intending to write memoirs, old chap, you should have said straight away."
May 5, 1995. On the teletext, impossible, merciless words, and a call to Smyslov to have these words confirmed. A long pacing around the room with racing thoughts that Troy is no longer, and then a slow realization that it would be no longer possible to say to him, without hiding behind irony or a joke, what I had not had time to say. But a strange thing. Within a few hours, when the initial pain had passed, and the soul, accustoming itself to anything, transfers he who lived into other dimensions and categories, and life continues without him, you begin to realize that there is considerable sense in the fact that the genuine presence of a person begins only after his death, just as an essential condition for immortality is death itself. On May 5, 1995, Mikhail Moiseevich Botvinnik began his journey to immortality.
This was a story from the book The Essential Sosunko. It is available at newinchess.com. A new podcast will be available every Friday on Spotify and Apple. Check out newinchess.com/podcast.